Okay, this is side two, continuing with Lex Mueller on 23rd August, 1973. So you were describing the...
Yeah, the binary calibration,
right?
So we could move the telescope, so that I felt at that time that the whole beam was really more or less directed
right.
into the pine tree. It was a very deep telescope, it was put with the focus inside the aperture plane, so... And at that time, the feeling that Cyclops were not so much to worry, probably wrong, but... So, in that way, we assumed that to be more or less 300 degrees. And the other position to the zenith was another calibration point. We assumed a couple of degrees.
Well, that base, and that was the basis of the all the hydrogen measurements for the next several years.
I must confess that later on I have tried to understand the calibration calculations, and I did cut out completely. How it has become so quite accurate, I think, is still a sort of accidental thing. Because if you do the recalculation with better knowledge about the tenet patterns and so on, and spill over things and so on. It works the wrong way.
The antenna pattern never really was
measured. No,
measured
only the main lobe.
Nor the illumination of the dish.
There were. We used a dipole with a reflected disc behind it, and
it
was rather elliptical beam with such a deep. But there were at that time no shape beam things available.
Nothing like
research was going on, I think, at that time. That they came later.
Right. Well, I guess the next step is Twingelow. All this time planning for the big telescope was going on.
Yes, was going on, and the telescope was being built at Twingelow. I was not involved very much on that. It was done by Hochhardt.
Right.
And I was kept informed, and we were, well, we had to make some arrangements for, the first idea was to get the receiver in a box behind the dish and have a long coaxial line between the focus and the antenna, and between the focus and the box, some 12 meters or so, for the Twingelow telescope, so we built...
Just to avoid blocking?
No. Not because of that, but the central arrangement. Let me see, I have to think about what has been the reason for that. The design for the telescope at that time was a single pole in the middle.
Mm-hmm.
And that couldn't carry much weight.
Right.
And I think there was the other argument was that at that time it wasn't necessary to put the equipment there, because the noise temperatures of the crystal receiver were rather high, and if you build a big coaxial line, the losses in that line were not so high that it would degrade the effective system sensitivity very much. So the idea was it was much simpler at that time to put the equipment at a point where you could handle it instead of doing awkward things at the focus.
But was this the final design of the telescope? No, with a single?
With a single pole. It has been like that for... there are pictures of that. Here, for instance, you have a picture like that with the central pole, and you could bring it down.
Oh, yes.
So that the end of the telescope could be reached from the ground. And the end of the pole could be moved. You could rotate it, and you could also move it up, and you could lengthen the lengthen the focal length so that you could bring the antenna exactly at the focus. Because nobody really knew what was how good the calculations would be, and whether there was not a sag in the reflector and so on. So it was decided that we should have. Something like 20 centimeters or so of movement in the focus.
And what was this design shortest wavelength to operate?
I think at that time, conservatively, it was put at 10 centimeters, being half that of 21 centimeters.
It was only to be sure you could do good 21 centimeter work.
Yes, the telescope was built for 21 centimeter. the design was somewhat better, so that it would be good at 21 centimeter, mm-hmm. I think.
Right.
But at that time, no ideas were there for doing 3 centimeter or 6 centimeter work.
Right.
The interest really was H-line work, not total power. That came later on when sensitivity improved and other people started to do continuum surveys.
Well, but now Westerhout survey was pretty early too.
Yes.
But maybe that's getting ahead too much.
Yes,
You moved to Twingelow in late 55?
I moved in August 55.
August 55. Right. The telescope was completed?
The telescope was...
ready for testing anyway.
For testing somewhat later, at the end of that year, I think.
Late 55.
Yeah, late 55. It was opened in spring 1956.
And the first useful observations were taken?
The first useful observations, oh yes, you mentioned that. First observations were already taken before I came, I think, by Charles Seeger. And so he was there.
Right.
And he did, with the telescope in transit, he did observations of the Crab Nebula, I think.
Is it?
Well, what was it? What did he do? There were some observations he did with this, some equipment where there was no need for moving the telescope.
Because the telescope wasn't finished yet.
It wasn't finished, yeah. But there was no movement available.
Right.
So, they could only move by hand to transit or something, mm-hmm. like that. And so something had happened. Oh, you'd better ask him exactly
what published the idea. In your memory?
No. No. Oh, no, it must have been an eclipse or something like that.
An occultation.
An occultation, yeah. And it didn't went too well, I think, so it wasn't published.
Well, that's in June, is the occultation of the Crab Nebula, so perhaps that was just a couple months before you
got there. Yeah, something like that. Or it has been a solar eclipse. I'm not sure. You'd better ask him. But there had been an observation where there was no motor movement at all in the telescope, where they could move a little bit in elevation or something.
Right.
And they did it in transit. Then we installed, when we came there, the receiver. Put a long coaxial line in the central pole of the dish. Installed the equipment in the two boxes behind the reflector. And installed a two-channel receiver in the building underneath the reflector.
The same one that had been used at Kodvac?
That was the same one that had been used in Kodvac, yes. And I think we were in trouble right from the beginning, because this long connection between the antenna and the front end didn't work. It meant that as a function of frequency, the antenna impedance, which wasn't exactly matched, only at one frequency, as a function of frequency, the reflection coefficient factor rotated very rapidly. It had I remember something like periodicity of the order of 7 megacycles or something. And that with the switching over 1 megacycle, there was such a large offset in zero line that it wasn't very good.
You were getting off at the baseline.
Also, the big baseline, the baseline was going like that.
It's sort of funny, you know, the problems that are being found now with large antennas with standing waves between the... This is similar in a way.
It's an old story. So it was no good. But we wanted to use a...
I'm not sure how we did it. Maybe I'm wrong here.
Because I think the receiver really was primarily used... so long ago. Primarily used for calibrating the telescope. That was the first thing that had to be done.
Right.
We had to know the scales and to get the calibration of the instrument. There we needed point sources, and so the equipment was used as a total power receiver. Not a very good total power receiver, but because it had no switching scheme on it, but it was just the H-line receiver.
And then that's all the bandwidth you had too? Or did you put in a wide band?
I think I'm not even sure.
Well, it's not so
important. No, it's not so important. Probably, if you look at Westerhout thesis, There is a description of
the
receiver,
and
that is the receiver that was the H-line receiver adapted for that purpose. So, well, the calibrations were difficult, I think. They had a bad season to get the optical calibration. There is a small telescope, and that's still there in the frame of the reflector, which was used for calibrating the scales on optical sources. And they had a very bad rainy season at that time, and only a few nights where they could observe, really. So it went all very slow, I think. But
this is all in early 56 now.
That is end 55. Maybe I should have a look at the Westerbork Seizes. It's first published in Westerbork Seizes, Westerhaus Seizes, and then later on in BAM.
Right.
And I think then for H-line it was not much good. And so then I think we started building a small front edge package, which is still, I think, at the Dwingelow Labs. It was a small cube of about 20 by 20 by 20 centimeters or so.
That could be put in the...
And that could be... that was really the dipole disc antenna with a... shaped and reflector I had. I had a small corner reflector built behind the dipole to shape really the antenna pattern,
right,
and have it in both planes or nearly exactly. So we had quite a good circular beam by doing that. And behind that reflector there was that small box of about 20 by 20 by 20 centimeters, and that housed the crystal mixer, which was now at 10 centimeters away from the actual antenna,
right.
And then the first IF amplifier, first few stages with the stabilizing resistors in the cathodes of the tubes, and so all that was inside that box. A lot of filtering and so, which I had learned in Kootwijk how to do that.
Right.
And
so this was the first front end box,
and that was really the first front end box, and that went up, and well, that has been used for quite a couple of years until we started using parametric amplifier.
Let me ask now. Let me make sure. All of Westerhaus survey then was done with the same receiver, basically, that did the Kootwijk survey.
That was the same receiver, and with the antenna at the focus, and the receiver at in the boxes behind the reflector with a long line between. Yes.
Was that in the longer?
Yeah.
The larger disc?
Yeah. It was essentially a total power receiver, which was the 21 centimeter.
I didn't realize that.
Yes. Well, you see, we had only few people, so we had only one receiver, and we had to work with that.
And what about the first hydrogen line work done? That was the Galactic Center, the 3 kiloparsec arm and so forth was going on at that time, was it not?
I'm not sure whether that was the first. I think one of the first things we did was really absorption lines. Really, look, there was the work by Hagen and so on.
Right, that was in 54.
That was in 54, and now we had a big telescope, and really we got out very fine profiles on a few sources. Which I still remember one of the really exciting things, getting such a large reflection, which were bigger than in the Cygnus area.
In the other direction.
Well, it was more something like 200 or 250 degrees negative or so.
Right.
You got all the details that were there, with all the small wriggles and components which were in those line profiles.
But you're still using the same filters as it called by also?
Yes, it was the same receiver. Yes.
Oh, I know something. You mentioned that you were hesitant to go to a multi-channel receiver. Why was this?
Mainly because then it would mean that probably the observing would go on, and we would pile up observations, which would...
That's right. You told me, because
would be reduced half a year later and so on, and then there would be no full feedback anymore between a reduction and results and our instrumental work.
Yeah.
So it's only later on when the computer came in the picture that then they were ahead of us, and then we started building our HM right. receivers. So that was always a shift from first we were faster, then they were faster, and so on.
Yeah.
And I think that was also because we were such a small group, there was no competition from other groups on doing other problems and so on, so that there was limited observing time. We had almost all the time available, except for some work done by Seeger, but that was a very limited time
yeah.
compared to the time available, so it didn't make sense to go much faster. But that meant that we were idling on the telescope time. And there were still a lot of problems to solve, really, to improve the zero line and all that sort of things.
Yeah. Well, okay, you got up to the putting stuff in the small front end box.
Yeah.
And that greatly improved your
yeah.
coax problems.
Yeah.
And
the other thing we did was, I think, very early, it has been the extragalactic work.
That's right. Yes.
On the
that was one of the first things done.
Yes. That was
M31.
M31, which was a great thing because nobody else could observe an extragalactic source in hydrogen except we.
With so much detail. Well.
No, there was
not at all.
There was some detail.
At Harvard, though, they had the 60-foot.
Hishin was trying to, but that's not my part. But then we had later on the Paris Symposium.
Right.
And there we could easily show that Hishin's results were wrong.
In what way? No, I don't remember this.
We showed comparisons between his profiles and ours, and ours were completely sensible
right.
in what you would expect, and his not.
And where did this arise from? Did this ever result?
I think he had not been too careful. I later heard stories about when you open the door, then the zero line will run away and so on. Probably a lot of his profiles were just
unstable receivers. Yeah.
And I remember quite well that, and that later on happened again on those measurements by him on coma cluster and so on.
Right, and then also the absorption in Cygnus, was it?
Yes.
There were a lot of spurious hydrogen line results in those days.
Yes. And, I remember on the coma cluster I did some observations myself which were completely negative. That has been published. But I remember standing with Hishin in one of the first days in the line for getting food at a conference, and then I said to Dave that I had done measurements on the coma cluster and that I couldn't find him. I don't quite remember what he said, but there was clear worry by him that about his own results
yeah.
in a way. He had fear that this might happen. Yeah.
He wasn't surprised.
No. So that was, I think, absorption, extragalactic things and so on. Not so much other galactic things. Because the big survey had been the Kodrak survey, and that was completed.
Right, and that was put together with the Australian results.
Put together, and the first results from Dwingelow were not so very much different, really. They showed some changes,
mm-hmm.
but they didn't give completely new results compared to what we had done in Kodrak.
Yeah. That had to wait, really, for the multi-channel.
Yeah.
Receiver.
Yeah. And I think.
So, what were you spending your time with during this time? After you got in the front end box, working.
I think that we started building more channels. I think.
And narrower.
Narrower too. Yes. 20 kilohertz. I think we had a.
By this time, you had gotten a second engineer. Also, is that correct? Or are you still working by yourself?
There was one second engineer for a couple of years, but he did solo work.
What was his name?
The Yatha. He's dead.
This is not the Diaker at Utrecht.
No, that's not the Diaker. He was a young Delft engineer.
Mm-hmm.
He later went to the States, has worked with Bell Telephones for a couple of years. But he worked mainly for the solar group.
Mm-hmm.
Because Utrecht really wanted to get into the picture of radio astronomy too. And
when did they do their first observations with the
We had those two Woodsburgs at the Dwingelo site.
Taken from Kotvik?
No, from Norway.
From Norway?
From Norway. Oh, you see how it is. You were working in Kotvik with the 7.5 meter telescope. It's a wonderful machine.
Yeah.
And those were post office things, we couldn't get those. But then we heard that we still could get from Norway to Woodsburg, if only we cared to fetch them. They were on a small island somewhere before the coast. Hooghout might tell you more about that. So we had them disassembled there and shipped and reassembled again.
Mm-hmm.
And those are the two that were in Dwingelo, and one of them has been used by Seeger in the very beginning for doing his calibration work with on Cas A. He built a wooden horn clad with chicken wire mesh, and that in conjunction with one of the Woodsburg was an interferometer for observing strong point sources.
I see.
And by knowing the gain of the horn, you could calibrate the flux. That is described somewhere in his early papers. So that was the Western Woodsburg, and the Eastern Woodsburg has been used by the Utrecht group for doing observations. I think the first observation on 400 megacycle. I think you could ask Dr. De Groot from Utrecht, if you want to know anything about that.
Mm-hmm.
De Groot, yeah. He is Tom De Groot. He has been involved from the very beginning in the Utrecht work on solar observation.
When exactly were these Woodsburgs placed at Kotvik?
They were there when I arrived, so in the same time. The Jager was involved in that work. I don't know exactly when he came, but that's probably, if you delve into the publications, you'll find that. And he built a spectrometer, I think a four-channel spectrometer near 400 megacycle for observing the fast solar burst of the order of fractions of a second.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a time constant and a very fast recorder and so on for that sort of thing, and that's still a type of work that's being continued
at the
Dwingelo dish now.
And that was headed by De Groot.
De Groot was the Utrecht man involved. He is a doctor in physics, studied at Utrecht, I think. He was the man from the Utrecht Observatory involved in the radio astronomy work, and the Jager was the man who built the equipment for them.
Right. And
later on, the Jager was that was a thing that I think Utrecht didn't quite like, was more involved into building equipment for the Dwingelo telescope too.
Mm-hmm.
Was distracted more or less from the solar work, and that led later on to the situation that Utrecht decided to cooperate more with the post office and to shift their telescope to the NERA station in Hilversum. So that has been away for a couple of years, and but the post office work was stopped at a given moment, and the telescope was transferred back a couple of years ago, and is now again on the site. So there are two Woodsburgs again in Dwingelo, but one has been away for a long time.
I see. And this is where Fokker comes in also.
Yeah.
And where is Fokker still at Utrecht?
Still at Utrecht, yes. But De Groot was earlier, and Fokker has...
The throat is probably more technically minded. Than Fokker came through the post office group. He was first employed by the post office great astronomy group and later taken over by the
foundation. You mentioned horns, and I was thinking, why were you... Was it just a matter of the technology of horns was not very developed in the late 50s, as to why you didn't use a
No, it, a horn feed? The trouble was I had to do with the central pole, and the central pole could not carry too much weight, and I had to support that box behind the focus again, because I didn't want to have a big obstruction in front of it. So. And then with a dipole feed, I could have a central coaxial line, which was also a supporting structure. And we could shape, by this shaped reflector, we had a good beam, so there was, at that time, not much need to go into a large horn.
So this is a matter of geometrical considerations, right?
Yeah. And it was nice to have a match between the coaxial antenna and the coaxial mixer and so on. You needed no transitions and so on. So. There was no need to do that.
Okay, well, I guess we're now up to around 1960 or so. You were building multi-channel things then.
Yeah.
And also see. This time, this must be about when the Benelux Cross...
That was starting to come up. I have not been involved very much in the beginning with the Benelux Cross. There was... The first ideas about that was a very large Mills cross in the same ideas, following the ideas of Mills in his first cross, an enormous affair of dipoles or connected up by cables and so on. Seeger was very enthusiastic about it, but I didn't believe it. And it was realizable with the sum of money he had in mind. So I kept a little bit apart from the idea. And I think, so that is a story that went... I had my work to do. I also was involved very much in the observation. It was not only the technical work, but I also had to lead the observational program and so on. So that kept me quite busy.
But when did you begin thinking about receivers for what became Westerbork?
I didn't begin it. There was the Seeger group was set up as the central group for the large cross antenna. Originally it was planned that the cross was going to be at the Dutch-Belgian border because of politics.
Right.
And some preliminary work was done by Seeger. He got a few men more to work with him, I think.
Well, Ericsson came and Herdenwald came.
First you could say Seeger was the project leader, but he left finally. And then they had quite a succession of project leaders. Ericsson, I think, first Christiansen. He was there at the time that Seeger was still there, and I think Christiansen really made the first design. Really based still on, no longer on the large dipole arrays, but on cylindrical telescope, but still on 400 megacycle, some 5 kilometer arms, something more, you'd say, a prototype of the Bologna cross ideas and so on.
Yeah.
That type. That was the first Benelux cross antenna ID, and that was put before the board of that separate thing. That was not the foundation who did it, but was the Benelux cross antenna project group, in which the Dutch astronomers in the foundation cooperated with Belgian astronomers. Mainly from Brussels and Liège, and there were in that board there were people from the governments and so on. It was quite a large affair. I was not involved at that time. Well, Seeger left, and I think then we had a succession of project leaders. Eriksson spent a year or so. Högbom was for a while project leader. Hochhardt has been project leader. And, finally, I ended up by getting involved in it because it was difficult to get somebody else.
By default,
By default, yeah. More or less.
All these people got tired of the politics involved in it, as opposed to the science? I didn't realize that all these people were project leaders. I knew they were all working at it.
They were all project leaders. Well, Eriksson came for a limited time, I think. Högbom came, but I don't think... He's not really a technical man. He was more interested in astronomy, really, and reductions and that sort of problems, but computer problems, but he wasn't interested in technique. And so he was not the right man to, in that stage, to direct a group which was involved in building receivers and so on. So there were some young engineers, they were doing all sort of experimenting with parts, but the grand idea of the receiver wasn't there yet. So things didn't really go too well. They didn't go too well on the political side as well. The Belgians had always said that...
I think they accepted in... They had accepted in principle they were going to cooperate with the Dutch. And we always said, make a good product, a plan for the whole thing, and then we will be able to decide in a couple of months. So I think that Christiansen's plan was put to the two governments, and the amount of money was quite different from what Seegers has been talking about. I think he was talking about, let's say, $1 million or so, something like that, and it turned out to be $7 or $8 million at that time. So there was quite a shift in an order of magnitude
difference.
And the Dutch government said, all right, rather soon, but there came no answer from the Belgians. And in the meantime, the ideas started to evolve, I think.
About what time was this now, when the Dutch government approved that?
What have I been? I have the notes not here, so it must have been the early 60s or something like that. But the Belgians, answer really came. The government hesitated, I think, and the project in the meantime also developed because the frequency of the 400 megacycle became uncertain. It was not certain that we could that sufficiently protect it in Europe. So, and also there was the general trend to shorter wavelengths, which led to the second design by Christiansen on the 21 centimeter. The 100 telescope project with 25 meter dish in 100 spread in two arms.
Right. That was about what time?
Oh.
Just roughly, I can check.
I think something like 63 or so, if I'm making a guess, but I'm not very sure, the timetable on this whole thing. I haven't looked it up. Finally, I think from we got we wanted to have an answer to know whether what we should do really, and because the project had been going on now for many years, and we needed to know what was going to happen. So there finally was a sort of a time, how do you call it in English? Really asked the Belgians to answer before a certain date.
Right. Ultimatum.
Mild ultimatum, is what you might call it. And, the date from the end passed and there was no answer. So then we said to them, we are sorry, but we're going our own way.
Yeah.
If you still want to follow it, that's fine. And that finally led to the... And then we had to change the project because we felt our Dutch money would be available still. Dutch half, something, some 50 million or something like that. That was half of the 30 million that had been mentioned.
Right.
For the project was still available, but we couldn't build across from that. And I think also at that time I became involved really in the whole affair. I said that I didn't believe in a 100 megahertz telescope, saying that we could build it and maintain it. That if we ever built it, it would be a very unflexible machine, and that it would be impossible to change frequency and so within any reasonable time, and that this was not the right thing to do. And then I think in the meantime, aperture synthesis had come in, the Earth rotation scheme was there.
Right.
And so that led to the final scheme. There were various interim versions by Hoekbaum of 30 telescopes fixed, which gave almost all the components which were needed in the scheme. But still we felt it was a rather stiff affair. You were, if you ever improved on illumination of the dishes, it would mean that the telescopes were too close together. And it wasn't very... I felt it was better to go to a very simple scheme and really go to a scheme with a movable telescope and a number of fixed dishes. Mm-hmm. Personally, I would have rather gone to a more limited scheme than Western work has become, rather go to 4 or 5 dishes in total, so that you had a rather simpler receiver scheme and would be more flexible. But well, with all the political background of the project, it couldn't be too small.
Right.
So the final compromise was then the 10 fixed and one movable. One movable at that moment.
I see.
The second came in later because the prices of the dishes turned out to be, and the final bidding turned out to be somewhat lower, and then what's that? So the total cost of the project was somewhat lower than what we had expected, and what said, oh, that's fine, then we put in a second one and argued that that is necessary, and that happened.
Right.
So they gave some extra money too, I think, for improving the speed of the project. So that made it into 2.
So that was the final design. That happened about when?
Final design. Must have been 65 or something like that.
Sounds about right.
Then I came in.
Now we may have skipped your work on Perrance and so forth at Twingalo. I have talked to Brian Robinson, who told me about his 2 years.
I see.
In the late 50s.
So we can start there.
I know a little bit about that.
That was Robinson and the Yacht. And those two did a lot of very good preliminary work on it. They went for a scheme with a two-stage apparent affair consisting of an up converter followed by a 2400 megahertz degenerate amplifier. That was the scheme. And that was also the scheme that Brian Robinson took with him to Australia.
Right.
He had a lot of troubles there, especially in the up converter. He wanted for CSIRO to have an up converter which would have coverage of in frequency tuning of about 100 megacycle or something like that, or rather long, wider even. But it turned out that there were a lot of parasitic peaks and dips in the passband of the up converter, which he traced down to all sort of harmonic effects in the up converter, and interference between the various frequencies which were present in the total scheme. So after Robinson left and the Yaga left too at that time, I was faced with the situation, what should I do? Continue it and try to make it. And then I decided I go back to the simplest thing and make a quasi-degenerate amplifier for 21 centimeters.
Well, that took half a year or something like that, maybe a year. It was quite an elaborate piece of work. Mr. Hinn, who's now at Westerport, mm-hmm. did nearly all the measurements. It was a very tedious affair, because there were no broadband network analyzers available that you have now. It all had to be done point by point measurements.
I see.
Make an adjustment and then point by point measure again, either with a slotted line or measure passband and so on. We had a lot of trouble with temperature effects that we didn't immediately discover, and you adjusted the paramp during the daytime. You had a fine passband at the end, and the next morning you came in and it was here. It wasn't. Had gone completely, and you started readjusting it and got it fine again the next morning again, and what we traced that was simply temperature effects. So we had temperature stabilized the whole thing. We used about J coolers for first we built the whole thing into a thermostat on 40 degrees Celsius. Another thing that we had to do was we had to change that focus arrangement to put in the a parametric amplifier, because there was no possibility with that central pole to put any big piece of equipment there. So that led to a change in the design of the telescope. We put in that tripod that's mm-hmm. still there. I think they're going to change it now to a four-legged affair fixed. But the present tripod was put in something like 63 or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Just to accommodate the parametric amplifier.
So up until 63, you were still using the Kopeck receiver modified for the front end box.
We had built a new eight-channel receiver, I think it was. And that was a quite elaborate machine, quite flexible, because the wishes of the astronomers went up. They wanted to have all sort of bandwidths. And also, we had extragalactic observations and observations in the galaxy. The extragalactic observations demanding wider spacings of the channels and detailed studies of pieces of profiles demanded a close spacing. So we had built a new receiver with eight channels, with electronic switching, central switching of the passband. Five, 10 and 20 kilocycles bandwidth. You had a central knob, and there you pull the switch, and then you had another bandwidth.
It was the same front end as a Kopeck, basically.
That was the same front end still, I think, but back end was the IF section was completely rebuilt.
Right.
Those were the drawers that we had in, probably still one in the show boxes in Ringelow. Large layers which housed a double IF channel and phase detector, etc.
Mm-hmm. And then, I guess from 53 until 63, it was basically the same front end.
From 56 or something, yeah, and